Hello and welcome to episode 207 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director here at the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum. And with me, but not with me today, is my esteemed co-host Bill Todi, former skipper of the Fast Attack Submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore Submarine Squadron 3 of Pearl Harbor, and many other assignments. Just before anybody has a coronary, Bill is perfectly fine. He's completely healthy. He's performing a task today that no one in their right mind wants to do, but he has to do. He's moving his home. So we had asked John to be on the show on this particular episode anyway, and today he's going to be acting once again as my fill-in co-host. Please join us in welcoming back our good friend and fantastic historian, the one, the only, John Parshall. How are you today, John?
I am great. It's just you, me, and my notorious wallpaper today. But looking forward to being your wingman. So
excellent. And we got some pretty cool topics to talk about today. We have some amazing aircraft we're going to discuss today and some significantly devastating tactics. With that being said, this week, John and I are going to dive into an event that is widely unknown, in my opinion anyway, and unappreciated in the realm of World War II Pacific history, specifically the combat history in and around the island of New Guinea. It's one of the rare instances in the Pacific War in which a battle was fought that was almost completely one-sided. To set the stage, the time period is March 1943. The location is the Southwest Pacific area, specifically the waters off New Guinea's southeastern coast. Allied air strength in the region had grown exponentially since the fall of Buna in January 1943. In only 2 months, the aerial strength of General George Kinney's 5th Air Force had doubled and damn near tripled in size and strength. Kinney's forces had become just that, a force to be reckoned with, and one that the Japanese grossly underestimated in terms of strength and ability, to their immediate detriment, as we shall see. In January 1943, the Allies, that is the Australians and Americans, had captured Buna, Gona, and San Ananda on the southeastern coast of New Guinea, thoroughly destroying the Japanese forces in the area and what was one of the bloodiest and most gut-wrenching campaigns of the entire war, not just Pacific War, but as John will readily agree, the entire war, the war as a whole. The Japanese still occupied portions of southeastern New Guinea, however, specifically Lae, and intended on launching new counteroffensives with their disease-ridden, depleted, and starving troops there. In order to launch that offensive and retake the initiative in the area, the Japanese realized fully that the forces in Lae had to be reinforced and resupplied with large amounts of fresh men and overwhelming materiel. To that end, a plan was hatched to do that very thing by sea from Rabaul, right through the area that was owned by Kinney's burgeoning 5th Air Force. The stage was set for an aerial destruction, the likes of which had not been seen since Pearl Harbor, in a little action called Battle of the Bismarck Sea. John, this is a unique event in the Pacific War, in my opinion. You know, it's almost entirely an aerial just beat down of biblical proportions.
Yeah.
Before we get to the ins and outs of the aerial melee, if you will, let's kind of set the stage. So, you know, following the Japanese decision to evacuate Guadalcanal and see defeat for all intents and purposes, the Japanese opted to shift their primary focus to the region in New Guinea. You had some things you wanted to say about that specifically.
Yeah, what's going on here is, you know, the decision is taken in December of 1942 at Imperial General Headquarters, and also in Rabaul, that, you know, we just can't do two campaigns simultaneously, and we can't sustain the level of naval attrition that we are sustaining at Guadalcanal, so we need to leave. And that evacuation is going to end up happening in February of 1943. What ends up happening from the Imperial Army's standpoint is they realize, too, that, you know, they've been dividing their attention between these two campaigns, and it's time to put in a proper command and control mechanism to run these two separate campaigns and recognize that they are going to be separate. And so they've already got 17th Army is operating on Guadalcanal under a General Hyakutake, and they decide that we need an entirely separate army, the 18th Army, for New Guinea. And so they establish that underneath the leadership of a gentleman named Adachi. Mm-hmm. And then over both of those two armies, they're going to create this new, what they call the 8th Area Army, which is going to be led by a gentleman named Imamura, Hitoshi Imamura, who was the conqueror of the Indies at the beginning of the war. He's a very competent general. And so they sort of pluck him out of his cushy digs in Badung, Indonesia, and send him over to Rabaul in mid-November to set up shop there. And so he's going to be riding herd over both of these armies. And in this operation that's coming up, General Adachi is going to be establishing 18th Army, and its headquarters are going to be in this convoy and are going to be moving to New Guinea to set up shop there. Mm-hmm. So, the Army commander Adachi is actually going to have a view of this entire battle as it goes forward.
How realistic were the Japanese, plans? I don't want to say plans. How realistic did the Japanese think it was that they were going to retake New Guinea? And did they really, obviously they think they had a chance, otherwise they're not, going to just send people in there for no reason.
Yeah. But, yeah. I mean, one of the things that you see throughout the war on the part of the Japanese army is this chronic over-optimism, regarding their ability to retake the initiative in any number of different theaters. You can see it happening in places like Burma as late as 1944. We're going to attack India and knock the British out of the war. Realistically, I don't think that the Japanese had a very good chance to do that. If for no other reason that New Guinea is just such a miserable place to be waging war.
Right.
And on the other hand, though, if you look at the length of the logistical lifelines to this theater, the Japanese line is shorter than the Americans. And so, at least in the short term, they should be able to do a reasonably good job of getting material into New Guinea. And intriguingly, too, I read an analysis by my friend Will O'Neill, who's a really talented operational analyst, and he demonstrated that throughout 1942 and at least the first half of 1943, the Japanese actually moved more aircraft and roughly an equivalent tonnage of supplies into this general theater. It's only about the middle of 1943 when things just start going pear-shaped for the Japanese. But I think from their perspective, again, they're betting on the fact that they feel that their troops, man for man, have superior morale, and that if they can put them in a position with decent supplies, they should be able to regain the initiative. I don't think that's realistic, but that's what they think.
That's what they're planning, and that's what they're hoping for anyway.
Yes.
Well, so they shift their focus to the southeastern portion of New Guinea, which I don't want to say they shift their focus. Their focus has always been in that area, but a lot has changed since January. Buna, Gona, San Ananda are gone in forms of Japanese possessions. It's controlled by the Allies, but they still have that like toehold on Leh, and they're still looking at this one area, and I'm probably going to pronounce it wrong, but it looks good to me. Wow.
And there's this whole area around Finchhaven and the Huon Peninsula in New Guinea. That's actually, honestly, where the majority of the fighting in New Guinea is going to be taking place for the next year. Mm-hmm. It doesn't not make sense to launch an offensive from there if they can beef up the forces at Leh sufficiently to do this thing.
Right, and that's the key, is beefing up those people there that are. If you listen to our first episode on New Guinea, know that they're withering away, if they're healthy, they're not that healthy. But the goal was to capture this area that the Australians were holding called Wow. Yeah. The reasons for that were many, not the least of which is it was an aerial tunnel in that valley right there.
Yeah. So Wow had never been abandoned by the Australians. And, it was reasonably close enough to Leh and so forth that they could do an overland march towards this thing. And when the Australians get wind that the Japanese are coming, and it's this famous episode where they start using C-46s and C-47s to bring Australian troops in, the airfield at Wow is just notorious. It is built on a 10-degree incline, and it ends in a mountain. Okay. So there's just, there is
nothing probably, to it.
Yeah, nothing to it, you know. And that brings you back to just sort of the hideous physical conditions in New Guinea. I mean, no one in their right mind would build an airfield at a place like Wau, but it was the best place to put an airfield in that neck of the woods, which gives you, you know, an indication of just how terrible the terrain is here.
Right.
So anyway, yeah. Once again, the flying conditions in New Guinea are just so primitive that they'd be laughable if they hadn't, you know, led to the deaths of so many young men there too. Yeah. It's awful.
It'd be laughable if it wasn't true.
That's right. Yeah.
Exactly. So to put it in perspective, the Japanese need to, or they think they need to capture Wau and this airfield area because it threatens their position at Leh. And in order to expand their toehold, they need to knock this out. It makes complete sense. You know, I mean, it's nothing different than what MacArthur's doing. You know, he's doing the same kind of thing. Yep. To that end, the Japanese devised a plan to reinforce the garrison at Leh by way of a troop transport convoy that would be protected by destroyers. Now, this is not the battle we're talking about. This is going to come, you know, before.
And one of the things at this point, Adam, I'm sorry to interrupt. You know, at this point, even the cruiser forces in this neck of the woods are pretty beaten up now on both sides. And so the naval combat really is devolving primarily to destroyers here for the next almost year or so. Right. Because after the Battle of Tassafaranga, which you've already covered, you know, the Americans have pretty much lost every damn cruiser they have left in the inventory.
Right.
They're, you know, you got their bows blown off or what have you. And so, yeah, what we're going to be seeing here for at least the next 6 months or so is a lot of destroyer combat.
Yeah, you're not going to see cruisers in the area until Kula Gulf, you know.
Kula Gulf and,
and even then.
The Bougainville and,
which is months.
Down the road.
Months away, yeah. And those are light cruisers. They aren't even the big boys. The Japanese had tried to do this very thing once before. They tried to supply Leh via seaborne convoy once before, and they actually succeeded. So on January 6th, 1943, a troop reinforcement convoy set out from Rabaul, bound for Leh with the goal of reinforcing the area. No different than what's going to happen here in March. Yep. The Allies were aware of the Japanese plans due to an ultra code break. And they knew the Japanese timetable. They knew, you know, how many ships were coming, blah, 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 blah. So the Japanese convoy, the one in January, now consisted of five troop transports protected by five destroyers. You know, it's an even distribution of shipping here. They were sighted by air by the Allies. They were attacked by air here and there, but the Japanese were under cover of a rain.
Right. Yeah, lousy weather.
Yeah,
right.
Really
piss poor weather. Which is also endemic. Yeah, to this neck of the woods too.
Yeah, and by it, you know, just the long and short of it is the Japanese make it. You know, they suffer through a couple of attacks. They lose a ship. They, you know, a couple of them get damaged, but they bring their people in there, and they deposit their people. They deposit their supplies into Leh right under the noses of the Allies. So, you know, they knew that this tactic worked. It had been proven. Yeah, it risky.
Right, but doable.
But doable, because exactly. I mean, they put down, let's see. Yeah, they deposited 4,000 guys in Leh. I mean, that's not a small number of people. You know,
no, that's not inconsiderable, right?
No. So, I mean, they dropped a fair amount of dudes out there and all their stuff, you know, right under the noses of the Allies, and we really couldn't do anything. And again, a lot of it was because of the weather, but still, you know, that it's a proven tactic. So it had been done before. They believed that it could be done again. However, the one thing I don't think that they took into consideration is that from January 1943 until March of 1943,
things changed.
The Fifth Air Force just went boom, and it got huge in terms of what it was before.
For the Pacific,
exactly. Yeah, I mean, this isn't the Eighth Air Force, but for the Pacific, this is a lot of birds, and it's a bunch of different kinds of birds, which we'll get to here in a minute.
Yeah.
So further Japanese efforts to reinforce the area had also succeeded. This is after the January mission, when the bulk of the Japanese 20th Division had been landed at WEWAC. You know, astute listeners will hear WEWAC and they'll think immediately Mushmorton USS Wahoo, because that's where they went.
Yeah.
The majority of the 41st Division was landed in mid-February, leaving the remainder of the 41st and the majority of the 51st still to be moved. The same practice of transports and destroyers set for March 3rd, 1943, which, by the way, coincidentally, is only 3 days from today. The 80th anniversary is only three days from today.
Yeah, good point.
For this particular transportation move, the Japanese would essentially take the exact same thing they did in January and add three on each side. So eight transports, eight DDs are going to make this haul from Rabaul all the way down to Leh. They acknowledged the fact that the plan was risky somewhat. They did a couple of war games on this, John. Do you have any insight on this?
I don't have any detailed information. I mean, yeah, the word that came back was risky, but, you know, should be able to do it.
But doable. Yeah. I think they said it was like a 50-50 chance. Well, what the hell isn't a 50-50 chance?
Right.
In all seriousness. So, but the one thing that the Japanese did for this particular operation that they didn't do for the January operation, or at least not to this degree, is they assigned a lot of birds to protect this convoy.
Right. Both Army and Navy.
Yeah.
Which is, again, unusual. You don't find a lot of instances in this war where the Army and the Navy cooperate all that well. But I think that there was, you know, sort of a recognition by the time the Guadalcanal campaign is winding down that this really is a joint operations kind of theater, and we're going to have to get along here, or you know, we're not going to be able to do anything credible.
Right.
There's also, frankly, a bit of a guilt factor on the part of the Navy. Recognizing that the reason the troops were starving on Guadalcanal is because we, the Navy, were not able to get the supplies to them that were necessary. And the same thing is already happening in New Guinea. And so there's kind of a moral obligation on the part of the Navy here to do everything in their power to support the Army in its operations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they're leaving these people out to wither on the vine.
Yeah.
I mean, for whatever reason, you know, be it Allied response or not, they're leaving them hanging there to dry. So on Valentine's Day, on February 14th, Allied recon aircraft picked up the fact that over 70 Japanese vessels were in Rabaul Harbor. Now, this isn't necessarily an odd kind of a thing, because Rabaul, of course, was...
Rabaul's the linchpin for the entire region in terms of Japan's, you know, defense there. And so, yeah, Rabaul is got a beautiful natural harbor, Simpson Harbor. And it also has three big airfields, I believe all of which had concrete runways as well. So, yeah, Rabaul is where a lot of Japanese shipping comes in and out during the war.
The thing with this recon mission, though, specifically, was not so much the amount of ships, it was the type of ships that were there that set General Kinney going, yeah, something's up here, because the aerial recon discovered over 40 Japanese merchant ships in and around the Rabaul. That's a lot of boats, man.
That's a lot
of carrying ships, yeah. stuff. You know, that's a lot of stuff. So at that point, 2 days later, Station Frumel, which is the code-breaking station in Melbourne, Australia, intercepted another Japanese message that revealed the intentions of the Japanese were to land what was then decoded to be five transports and five destroyers by Leh. They were going to land at Leh, I'm sorry, by March the 5th. And actually, of course, we know now that it was eight and eight, not five
eight
and five.
And
but regardless, the numbers are neither here nor there. The Allies knew that the Japanese were going to be coming. Frumel told Kinney that he could expect the Japanese reinforcement group to disgorge approximately 7,000 troops on the beaches of Leh on March 5th. At that point, Kinney goes, that's a lot of dudes, and we got to do something about this. So he immediately runs to MacArthur, and Mac, to his credit, which you won't hear me say that often, but Mac, to his credit, immediately goes, yeah, this is a problem. George, you do whatever you need to do and eliminate these people and these ships like yesterday. Get this done and get it ready to go, rock and roll, and don't let these people land on my beach. To that end, Kinney moved just about everything with wings into and around the area, so as these people wouldn't, and I think some of them did. I know I'm pretty sure, John, the B-17s had to fly over the Owen Stanleys, but
yeah, that's right. They're going to be based at Moresby, because that's the only place that's got a runway decent enough to put them. Dobadura is going to expand at one point. I think there's five or six airfields around Dobadura. There's a whole complex of airfields. I don't know how many were in operation at this point in time. They were certainly basing fighters on that strip. And also Milne Bay down at the tip of New Guinea is also going to be used in this operation. So there are at least three different air base areas that are going to be contributing the whole gamut of air power, from heavy bombers at Moresby to medium and light bombers, and then fighters as well.
And it is a motley crew of aircraft that yes. are going to be here. And I'm not talking about Nikki Six. I'm talking about, there's a whole bunch of birds that are coming here. A lot of birds that frankly, in my opinion, are just wicked cool, but you don't hear about them a lot. This is kind of one of the only areas that you do, and we'll get to that in a second. So the forces with Kinney's command were an assortment, as I said, of heavily armed, long-ranged aircraft, or medium-ranged aircraft, depending on what you're talking about here. The B-17s were there. There were quite a few B-17s. There were some B-24s that were at this time used mainly as long-range scouts. Yeah. They did conduct some attacks, but the 17s were the main striking power of heavy bombers in this general vicinity. These are going to be, the 17s were, of course, designed to be high-level bombers, but in this particular theater, at this particular location, they're not. They're mid-level, I'd say
7,000 to 8,000 feet, something like that. Yep.
Yeah. Considering when they're operating in Europe at 25,000, this is
right.
This is low. American fighters in the area included P-40s of the 49th Fighter Group, as well as P-39s and P-38s of the 35th Fighter Group. One P-38 in particular was piloted by a guy named Dick Bong, who, if you haven't heard of him before, you will in the near future, believe you me. Royal Australian fighters were there as well. Now, the Aussies played a huge part in this event. They're flying P-40s as their main fighter aircraft here, but their attack aircraft are freaking nasty, man. Bow fighters. Good gravy.
Yeah. So,
and that's the teeth of the 5th Air Force right here. This is the bite. It's the fighters are great and fine, and they do a great job. And the B-17s, to a point, do a good job too. But it's these medium, fast attack aircraft, A-20s, B-25s, the bow fighters, and,
those three really are sort of the troika of batitude. So, we'll nerd out on those.
You ain't kidding. I mean,
yeah.
So on the Australian side, as I said, they had Lockheed A-29 Hudsons, which are not, they would have been easy meat in Europe, frankly, in my opinion, but in the Pacific.
Yeah. Well, and that's a larger talking point. Kenny is getting the cast offs, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a problem for his Air Force throughout the war, is that the emphasis, as far as the Allies are concerned, is always going to be on the air war in Europe, and they are going to get the top of the line equipment. And so Kenny is going to have to make do with whatever he can scrape up. And yes, he does have a polyglot of forces here. There's some B-26s that are not going to be used in this battle because they're fairly high mile. The P-40 Kitty Hawk as a fighter gets kind of poo-pooed because it was an older airframe, but it was perfectly capable, if flown correctly, of holding, doing a dogfight, not a dogfight with a Zero, but doing combat with a Zero. P-38 hadn't been all that successful in the European theater, but in the Pacific, it was a wonderful airframe because it had two engines. People forget how awful the weather often is here, and you're making these long overwater transits. If you get a mechanical on one of your engines, you get a problem. And the 38, has two engines. It also, just from a gun platform standpoint, is a wonderful platform because all of its armament is centerline mounted. It's got a 20 millimeter Hispano Suiza cannon and 450s. I mean, that's a lot of boom boom for a fighter. Anyway.
And they're pretty quick. I mean, a P-38 can, it can scoot when it needs to. It's a good high altitude fighter for the Pacific area, as you said. Yeah. And it can tangle with a Zero.
Yeah, absolutely. If you use the right tactics again. Right. I would just, for the sake of our audience, I'm just going to go ahead and, I know you have this book as well. But this is Eric Berger's Fire in the Sky. And if you want to really nerd out on Pacific aircraft and their you know, how they went about their business and their relative merits and so forth. I can't recommend this book highly enough. It's just a wonderful read.
It is a good book. It is another good one, but it's another topic for later on in the Air Wars, Race of Aces. Have you heard of this? This is a good
book. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, John Burning.
Yeah, very great book.
Great guy too.
So we talked about the Aussie fighters. Let's talk about the Aussie medium attack aircraft because they're just badass. They're both made by Bristol. One of them's a Beaufighter. The other one is the Beaufort.
Right.
But the Beaufighter specifically, John, this
Beaufighter. Yeah, the Beaufighter is a sort of a heavy fighter variant of the Beaufort medium bomber. And what a cool plane. Yeah. I mean, it's got these, you know, two big Merlin engines that stick way out in front of the nose. And so it's just got this bizarre kind of looking profile. It's ostensibly a 2-seat airplane, except the observer sits in this ventral, you know, sort of bubble in the back of the middle of the airplane and the pilot up front. But its real claim to fame, you know, it's got 4 20 millimeter cannons. That's and insane. 6 303 machine guns. So again, just in terms of, you know, amount of lead going downrange, it's a pretty fast airframe and it has a lot of firepower.
Yeah, I mean, you got 3 and 3 in each wing, and then those 20s that are just sitting right smack in the
fuselage. Yeah. God. So again, just from a nerdery standpoint, you know, if you're doing air combat, one of the problems with having your armament in the wings is it's got to be, you know, aimed in such a way that it's going to converge in front of the airplane, you know, 300, 500 yards, something like that. It's, you know, very carefully calibrated to converge out there. Having your armament in your fuselage, on the other hand, means that you don't have to worry about convergence zones or anything. You just point your nose at the target and you shoot. And so the Beaufighter has got that, you know, because all four of its 20s are sitting in the fuselage of that plane. And that is going to be the advantage too with the American bombers that we're going to talk about as well.
Enter Pappy Gunn. Pappy Gunn is a very unique individual.
Yeah.
Shall we say. He was a what I would term as a tinkerer, you know. Yep. People say an innovator, and he was. But he's the kind of cat that, you know, if you're living next door to him, he's got a shed in the back and he's back there trying to rig up stuff to make it work.
Yeah.
All the time.
Pappy, he had retired from the military. He took a job out in the Philippines. He was working for the airlines out there. He moved his wife and kids out to the Philippines, and they were all living in the Philippines before the war. The balloon goes up. He's got a reserve commission, and in the, you know, the craziness, he ends up having to leave the Philippines, and his family are captured by the Japanese. So this is a guy who has a major chip on his shoulder because, you know, he doesn't know what's happened to his family. Mm-hmm. He's an old dude by Pacific standards. I believe he's 41 when he's, you know, he ends up in Australia, and he's got, I can't even remember his official role there, but he's in, you know, like a repair depot or something like that.
That's exactly what he was doing. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, General Kenny has just taken over this Air Force and is kind of making the tour of the bases and encounters Pappy, who is modifying these, you know, these A-20s and Kenny asks him, you know, what are you doing? And he's like, well, these, you know, these aren't real great as light bombers, but I'm going to turn them into strafers so we can go after, you know, shoot up airfields and barges and stuff like that. And, you know, and he's completely upfront about the fact that he doesn't actually have any business doing this. Right. But Kenny, you know, to his credit, recognizes that I'm in this backwater theater and I've got to have cats who are innovators. And he sees what this A-20 strafer can do. He's like, this guy knows what's going on. He's now my Mr. Fix-It. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to make him, you know, my special projects dude to just gin up crazy ass weapon systems. And that's what Pappy is going to do for him for the rest of the war.
And he's incredibly successful at it. And he, I would venture to credit him with not only obviously the, and we'll talk about the B-25 in a second, but you know, the reclassification of the B-25 for the Pacific, but the change in tactics for the Army Air Forces in this entire theater,
right,
with the exception of the B-17s, is a result of Pappy Gunn's tinkering with aircraft airframes.
No, I think that's right. And so big picture, you know, the Army Air Corps is all about strategic bombing. And right. So they've got this theory of how you go about, you know, disassembling an enemy in a strategic sense. And they're using that over in Europe. You know, you go after logistics nodes and you go after, you know, petroleum depots and factories and blah, blah, blah. None of that stuff applies in the Pacific.
Right.
There aren't any roads. You know, there's no factories to bomb. There's none of that stuff. And right. So you see this evolution then in the way that air power is going to be used in this theater. Basically, you have to throw out the whole rule book in the Pacific in terms of how you're going to do air power. You're going to go after different types of targets. Mm-hmm. And among other things, shipping is really, really important. That's how stuff gets moved around. And so Kenny recognizes that I've got to figure out more effective ways of going after Japanese shipping. Bombing them from high altitude, that ain't going to get it done. How do I go about attacking these things? And when we say shipping too, we have to use that in a fairly broad context, because not only are there Japanese transports, what we're going to be talking about, but even by this time, the Japanese are beginning to move a lot of stuff around at night using barges and landing craft, you know, keeping them under cover during the day and then moving around at night. And so I need assets that can go after that kind of stuff as mm-hmm. well.
Mm-hmm. And you need fast, quick, low altitude flying
right.
strikers, and a B-17, God bless it. And that ain't it. That's not
the right kind of airframe. Yeah,
new. So to that end, he takes the A-20, to your point, John, he adds 450 calibers in the nose of this thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, he turns.
And just the fact that, you know, he's got the guts to, I'm not sending this back to, you know, to America to be retrofitted. I've got sheet aluminum here. I know what I need to do, you know. And so he is, you know, ripping and pulling and cutting and, you know, mm-hmm. pulling out machinery and doing whatever, which is going to change the way the plane flies. You know, mm-hmm. this is kind of risky, seat of the pants kind of engineering, field engineering. But again, he's gifted at this sort of thing, and he understands how to do this in a jury-rig kind of fashion, and he's very successful at it.
His most successful baby, if you will, is the B-25 Mitchell. Now, the Mitchell, of course, is a famous airplane in the Pacific, mainly because of the Doolittle raid. But this is where, in my opinion, again, this is where the Mitchell really leaves its mark in a Pacific theater, is in this very type of role after Pappy Gunn gets a hold of it. He, to quote him, he said, "I pulled everything out of the nose of the B-25, including the bombardier."
Right.
And he throws just automatic weapons out the wazoo in the front end of this thing. He's got, in some variations, now he tinkered with it until he found the right, you know, recipe, if you will. In some variations, he hasn't installed as many as 8 50 caliber machine guns in the nose of the B-25.
Yeah, 2 banks of 4. Yeah.
God dang. And then later, he installed an additional 4, 2 in each on the cheek, like cheek blisters, if you will.
Right.
I mean, he
rips out the belly turret because he can't aim that thing and it just slows the bird down anyway. Mm. He rigs all of these guns so that they can be fired by the pilot. So I don't need a bombardier anymore. It becomes, you know, a 3 or 4 person machine. I've got pilot, co-pilot. I got the top gunner. I've got the tail gunner. Although I can't remember in some of those, he gets rid of that as well.
I think he does for the weight.
Right. And so what you've got here is just this big flying machine gun, if you will. Because if you crank the top turret forward, you can easily have, you know, 8, 10, a dozen forward firing 50 caliber machine guns on this thing. The cyclic rate of the Modus, the aircraft version, is between 750 and 850 rounds per minute. So I just ran the numbers on this, you know, figure 800 rounds a minute, a dozen guns firing forward. That's 9,600 rounds a minute. That's 160 bullets a second.
Big bullets too.
Big bullets. Yeah. 50 caliber slug is a big, heavy slug. And, you know, there's a lot of nerdery around, you know, is the 50 as good as the 20? I mean, generally, probably not. But for, again, for this sort of purpose, which is smothering the opposition and frankly doing structural damage to things as well, a lot of bullets coming out of the end is a beautiful, beautiful thing. The other thing that he does with the B-25 too is they rig it up. Kenny also has his own innovation called the parafrag, which is a little 25-pound bomblet that gets dropped and drops down on a parachute, and it's a fragmentation bomb that he envisions is going to be really useful against parked aircraft, because the other thing that the strafer has got to do is be able to attack airfields. And so the combination of forward firing 50 caliber machine guns and then dumping, you know, dozens and dozens of these parafrags out of this bomber as it comes over at low level, this thing is going to be devastating against enemy airfields.
So Pappy Gunn, after he installs all this weaponry aboard these B-25, he rechristens it. And it's not a, you know, actual classification, but I think it was funny. He called them commerce destroyers.
Yeah.
Which they are. So this is not the only innovation that the Allies are, and I say Allies because the Aussies are, you know, neck deep in this operation. Yeah. This is not the only tactic or innovative tactic that the Allies are going to throw at the Japanese in this particular bombing, strafing fighter, you know, massacre. Right. Skip bombing is something that the Germans used in Europe, but the Aussies kind of perfected it in the Pacific here. And we, being the Americans, see this and go, this is a really cool way to hit ships if you can make them maneuver in such a way as for this tactic to work. And it's pretty simple, really, if you think about it. So it's high altitude, even medium level altitude, strategic straight and level B-17 bombing in the Pacific theater had been horrible.
Yeah, woefully ineffective. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, had they hit some ships? Yes. But had they done even a third of the damage that they claimed to do? No. Not even close. So to your earlier point, the traditional tactic, Army Air Force's tactic of just straight and level, dropping your eggs and going home.
No,
it don't work out here, man. It doesn't. So this is something that the Army Air Forces wants to try and do. This is something that the Aussies do, and they actually perfect it. And it's pretty simple, and it kind of goes like this. So using their Hudsons, Beaufighters, and Beauforts as test examples, the Australians would fly just above wave top height. And I'm talking like, you know, maybe 20, 30 feet high.
Yeah.
Friggin' low.
Really low.
Low. Literally, they would literally throw the ordnance against the sea and skip it as you would take a stone and skip it across a lake.
That's exactly right.
And just try and smack the side of the ship. And the starboard of the port side is what they're aiming at here. They're not aiming for the bow.
Right.
They're not aiming for center mass of the deck or anything. They're trying to smack that sucker in the side. Not that the bomb is going to penetrate the hull, although in some cases it may have. I don't know.
Yeah.
The theory is that it's going to hit the side of the vessel, drop down, and it has, what is it, a 5-second delay fuse or something like that?
I can't remember the exact delay, but yes, they do put it on a delay because they want the bomber to be able to clear the ship before it detonates.
Exactly. And the theory is that when this thing goes kaboom, it's almost like a mine hitting the ship as opposed to a bomb. And it's just going to throw all this kinetic force, as you so aptly put, this kinetic woof into the side of this vessel.
Yeah, the bottom line is that there's enough structural stuff in the middle of a ship that if you skip a bomb into the side of this thing, it's going to lodge itself inside the ship someplace. You know, a 500-pound GP bomb has got enough sufficient kinetic energy that it is going to go through, you know, a quarter inch of mild steel. And it's going to end up somewhere in the innards of that merchant vessel, and then it's going to go kaboom. But you want that plane to have gotten enough time to get past it before it does its thing. Because, you know, we have eyewitness accounts from some of these pilots. When they actually drop this bomb and they're skipping along, you know, you're looking out the window and your brother pilots are doing the same thing. And these bombs are skipping along at the same speed as your plane. I mean, they're just right alongside you. It had to be a very... kind of bizarre sight.
It had to be surreal, a little bit of a pucker moment, you know?
Yeah, pucker moment for sure. The other tactic that they're going to innovate as well is what they call masthead height bombing. And so same general flight plan, except you're going to try to get the bomb in a direct line straight into the target. So you're going to drop it, a couple hundred yards, if that, away from the ship, and then zoom right over the top of the ship as this thing goes into it. The same delay fusing and the whole thing.
Yeah.
And you can do both of these tactics at the same time. I mean, the B-25 is going to be carrying several of these 500-pound bombs. So, come in, light up the target with your 50s, drop one bomb that's going to skip, and then as you get close to the target, drop another one that's going to, at masthead height, and then away you go. So,
and that's exactly what they're going to do. And that's a key point, is they're going to strafe before they bomb, or as they're on their bombing run, they're going to strafe. Right. And that's going to eliminate a lot of human beings on the decks of these ships. And we'll get to that here in a minute, but you got to, the viewer listener has to remember too, that Japanese troop transports won't necessarily troop transports in the way that you think American troop transports were. All right. So getting back to it, the Japanese convoy leaves Rabaul on the 28th of February, which is 80 years ago today, as a matter of fact, with a total of the aforementioned 16 ships, 8 transports, 8 DDs. The convoy was heavily escorted by over 100, well, theoretically, at one point or another, by over 100 Japanese fighters. That's a lot of birds for the Japanese to put in the air at one time. I don't recall them doing that at Guadalcanal at all, not to that degree.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lot of planes. Yeah,
that's a lot of airplanes. So the route for this particular convoy, as opposed to the one from January, is a little bit different in that the convoy is going to hug the northern coast of New Guinea in hopes that the Allies would be deceived as to the actual port. Now, little did they know that we already knew where the hell they were going, to force the Allied aircraft to fly over New Britain, which is where a lot of the Japanese fighter bases and airfields are. So the theory is that if the Allies fly over New Britain, then we'll be able to rise up and pick them off one by one, because we know they're coming. It's just a matter of how many can we knock out before they waylay us, for all intents and purposes. So actually, despite being aware that the convoy was on the move, and the Allies were completely aware that the convoy was on the move, we couldn't find them, even though we knew where they were coming from, at least initially. And by that initially, I mean a couple of days, right?
Yeah, it took a while. Yeah, that's right. And again, weather had something to do with it as well.
Yeah.
Welcome to operating in the tropics.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's going to rain, What do they say? If you don't like the weather, if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes and it'll change.
Right.
Yeah, it's like living in South Louisiana. But anyway, at dawn on March the 2nd, 6 Royal Australian Air Force A-20s. Let me back up a little bit. American B-24s do sight the convoy. They sight the convoy on March the 1st. So this is literally the day after they set sail. The Japanese realize this. They can see the B-24 in the distance, and they're like, it's coming.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
It's just a matter of how much and how bad
the
beating is going to be, but they know it's coming. Yeah. And it does come, at least on March the 2nd. The very first few attacks come by the A-20s, by the Australian Air Force's A-20s. But they don't attack the convoy. And this is kind of interesting in that we know the convoy is coming, but this goes to show the depth of the intelligence analysis that's being performed by Kinney's people and Station Frumel, is that they know that the Japanese are coming. They're not even worried about hitting the convoy because I know they're going to get to it, but they know that there's an intense amount of Japanese fighter aircraft activity over and around this convoy. So they're like, convoy can wait. Let's go get these.
Degrade the air assets first, right? So we're going to go shoot up these airfields and get as many planes on the ground as we possibly can. And, the A-20, sort of the baby brother of the B-25 strafer, fabulous plane for this kind of a mission because it's so fast. Four or six, 50s in the nose of that thing, it too can make a real mess out of an airfield.
It's interesting to see how they did that, though. It's almost cocky.
Yeah.
In a way, it's like, we know we're going to get these guys, so let's just, pick them here and pick them, kind of like a cat playing with a mouse, It's, yeah. It's, yeah.
It, Yeah, I was going to say, get rid of the enemy air power. I mean, and that's fairly standard doctrine too. You want to, you know, sure, assert air superiority first, and the way you do that is by attacking the enemy's airfields.
And that's what they do to a T. At around 1000 hours, around 10 o'clock in the morning, another B-24 sights the convoy, and they start tracking it. And this particular B-24 tracks this convoy for hours. I mean, they just kind of shadow it, and you know, they're out of range, even though the fighters, Japanese fighters, know that they are there. They kind of leave this 24 alone, which is also kind of bizarre to me.
Yeah, well, it's tough to get up to where the 24 is operating. There's probably cloud cover as well.
Yeah,
you can see why the Liberator was such a sought after plane from a scouting standpoint. Mm. The design of its wing was really, really innovative, and so it was a very long ranged bomber.
Yeah, was Davis wing is what is when.
Yeah.
It's a cool airplane. Ugly, but it's a cool airplane.
Ugly but cool. Right.
So because the 24 is tracking this convoy, it allows B-17s, which are obviously much slower than B-25s and A-20s and bow fighters and Beauforts, to get up into the air and make an attack on this convoy. They make a medium altitude attack at about 5,000 feet. And they're soon followed by another, these are 8-17s, and they're soon followed by another flight of 20. In this particular attack, the 17s are harassed by the escorting Japanese fighters until American P-38s arrived on scene. Now, the 17s actually they were supposed to have 38 escort the entire time, but they got there too early, which is kind of, you know.
Coordinating these air assets from different airfields is tough to do. That's the bottom line.
Well, that and to your point with the weather, you know, that also had a issue in it too, getting everything together, everybody in the air at the same time. In the air battle, 8 Japanese fighters are shot down and a further 13 were damaged. Now, I mean, still with a significant flight, that's not a huge loss, but it is something, and it's pecking away at that fighter escort, just slowly pecking away at it. True to previous form, and when it comes to the B-17s, they didn't hit squat.
Right.
I shouldn't say that. They did, but they overclaimed results.
They actually do get a transport.
Yeah.
And end up putting about 1,200 guys in the water. Yeah. And so, you know, a couple of these Japanese destroyers pluck a bunch of these guys out of the water and are going to, you know, race them into Ley. One of those destroyers is the luckiest ship in the entire Japanese Navy, the destroyer Yukikaze. Which is going to go through the entire war, as a matter of fact, without, being sunk. And she's been at pretty much all the big battles in the beginning of the war. She's going to go through a lot of the ones at the end, too. But yeah, Yukikaze is in here doing her thing, plucking guys out and running them into Ley.
Yeah, they pull out, you know, it's an estimated between 900 and about 1,000 guys, you know, we'll just say 950 to split the difference.
Yeah.
And they bring these people too late, to your point, John. And this is actually, as you'll see, this is the largest transportation of people that this convoy actually performs here. The DDs pluck these guys out of the water and just haul ass to Ley, you know, because they can make upwards of close to 40 knots, 30, you know.
These are 30, probably 34, 35 sustained. But yeah, these are speedy vessels. Yeah. The Japanese were known for that.
Yeah, so they get these people out of there, out of the water, and they put them on the beach. And then these two destroy, I think it's, is it two?
Yeah, it's two, Asagumo and Yukikaze. And then they're going to come back and rejoin the convoy again tomorrow on the 3rd.
Right. And the 3rd is when the defecation hits the ventilation, really is.
Yeah, exactly.
On the 3rd of March, and this is important, the convoy starts to reach the outer edges of medium to light bomber range and the fields at Milne Bay specifically. Mm-hmm. This is where, we're still focusing on the Japanese air cover. We're still trying to, you know, hint, you know, peck at these people as they're coming along, because the convoy is continually being escorted by Japanese aircraft. Fully aware that the convoy had heavy air protection, we're deeming it necessary to, as you said earlier, knock that out so as to leave the ships easy pickings. Yeah. And that's exactly what's going on here. Royal Australian Air Force Bostons are attacking the Japanese airfield again at Ley, and they're doing this essentially all day long. They're keeping these people's heads down. You know, they're riddling aircraft on the ground. They're potholing the runway or the tarmac, whatever it may be. You know, they're making life miserable for the Japanese at Leh.
Yeah, exactly right.
So again, at about 10 o'clock that morning on March the 3rd, the convoy was attacked by another force of 13 B-17s from about 7,000 feet. And this is important. In the attack, Japanese convoy began to scatter. And this is exactly what we wanted them to do.
Yep. Break up their formation, right? Yep. And a word is in order here on just how bad the anti-aircraft suites on board these destroyers are. In theory, the 5-inch guns on Japanese destroyers were capable of engaging aircraft, but the truth was that their mounts were typically fairly slow to traverse. They didn't have a lot of elevation. They weren't particularly fast firing. These were guns that were optimized for anti-surface warfare. And that means that the majority of the firepower from the Japanese destroyers is going to be delivered by their 25 millimeter guns, which is not that great an AK-AK weapon. And so if you can shove the convoy apart, these have got relatively short range, you know, coverage envelopes, if you will. So by dispersing the convoy, it's going to pretty radically degrade the effectiveness of the destroyer anti-aircraft fire.
What little there actually was in the first
exactly.
place.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is precisely what happens here.
Yep. Yeah, this would be an entirely different battle if they were going up against 8 American destroyers that had their 5-inch 38s. And, you know, this is a different kettle of fish in terms of the effectiveness of the anti-aircraft fire.
Big time. In the aerial battle that occurs, and this is also very important because it has something to do with a very grisly event that happens later. There is one B-17 is shot down. One of I don't know the name of the B-17. I don't know the name of the crew, you know, that was usually named after the pilot, the partial crew or something like that. But regardless of this, people bail out of this airplane. And in the process of them bailing out and floating down to the water, they are machine gunned, all of them, by Japanese aviators, either in their parachutes as they're drifting to the sea or in the sea once they get in the water. And the Japanese aircraft that execute these Americans in their parachutes are promptly shot down by P-38s, but not before they do kill every single one of these people that parachuted out of this airplane. This is no bueno. This is bad news.
This sort of behavior occurs on both sides. And you know, if you read Bergerud's book, he'll give you accounts to that effect as well. There's just not a lot of love lost between these two opponents. That's one way of putting it.
And it starts at the beginning of the war and it goes all the way through the damn war. You know, there's no quarter asked, no quarter given by either side.
That's the deal.
You know, and Americans are going to sit there and go, oh, my God, these horrible people. Well, just wait.
just wait for it.
Just wait. So the convoy is now dispersed like, you know, ants and now, in an anthill.
Yeah. And for the first time now, we're within range of these strafers and in they come. And here is their debut. And I think it's fascinating that when you and I were both prepping for this episode, that we both picked out the same passage from Bergerud's book to describe what one of these pilots witnesses as he goes in on one of these ships. And so with your permission, I think I'll just crack it open here and
lay it on us.
Yeah, do this thing. So this pilot is flying his B-25 and, you know, first some of the fighters go in to suppress the anti-aircraft fire, and then the strafers go in. And he writes, they went in and hit this troop ship. When I looked like little sticks, maybe a foot long or something like that, or splinters flying up off the decks of the ship. They'd fly all around and twist crazily in the air and fall out in the water. I thought, what could that be? That must have some peculiar cargo on that vessel. And then I realized what I was watching were human beings. It was a troop ship just loaded. When the third group hit them, two of the ships went in and unloaded with those 16 machine guns. And most likely the turret gunner upstairs was having a little fun too. I was watching hundreds of those Japanese just blown off the deck by those machine guns. They just splintered around the air like sticks in a whirlwind, and then they'd fall in the water. That gives you a sense for just the incredible power of those mass machine guns. I mean, just hosing those decks off and blowing the guys overboard. Again, 160 bullets per second coming out of the front ends of these things. That's just absolutely horrific. Some of the other pilots would remark too that when they hit the side of the ship, they could see the ship shuddering under the impact of these bullets. You know, a single 50 caliber machine gun can take apart a wooden framed house. Mm-hmm. You think about, you know, 8, 10, 12 of these things, even against a steel object like a ship, they're just absolutely going to perforate it and in some cases literally shake it apart and start causing structural failure on these things. So yeah, they're just shooting these ships to pieces.
Yeah, I mean it's hard to fathom if you think about it. And what you said, hosing the decks off of these ships, that's a really good way to put it, because that's exactly what they're doing. Is they're just spraying a stream of lead so thick and so heavy that it's literally wiping clean
yes,
anything that's topside of those ships. And it's something to remark about too. Japanese troop transports are not like American or Allied troop transports, and that's, you know, in some cases we took luxury liners and transformed them into mm-hmm. troop transports. These are basically any kind of ship that floats that they can stick people on and as many people as they can in and on. And a lot of these guys, being hot in the tropics, they're going to go topside to get some air. And that's what happens to a lot of these people. And they're just absolutely devastated by these aircraft. And most of these, they're doing this, are the 25s and the bow fighters, you know, and right. The bow fighters are kind of coming in and cleaning the deck. And then the B-25s are doing, you know, they're kind of, you know, pitching in afterwards. And then they're coming in and they're dropping their bombs.
Yeah.
The right behind these bow fighters and these early strafers and B-25s are the 71st Bomb Squadron. These are also B-25s. They board in straight at the Shirayuki, Japanese destroyer. In the attack on her, nearly everyone topside became casualties, and even more were killed. One bomb hit her magazine, blowing the stern off of the ship.
Yeah.
This is just one. This was one attack. Another destroyer was sunk, yet another was hit and collided with a transport, with both eventually being sunk later. So you can imagine this is absolute, utter chaos that is going on within this, what's left of this Japanese formation. It's people running all to hell and gone, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So you've got ships maneuvering all over the place. These destroyers are trying to keep up high speed and be everywhere at once. And of course they can't be. They're being hit from all sides of the compass because, you know, we know that by hitting them from various angles, it's going to make the anti-aircraft problem just that much tougher. Yeah. It's absolute chaos and a nightmare. You mentioned one of the destroyers being hit. That's actually Tokitsu Kaze, which is carrying General Adachi, which is the commanding officer for 18th Army. And so, you know, his ship is knocked out in the middle of this attack, and he is actually going to transfer over to who else? Yuka Kaze. Picks up General Adachi and his command staff and the crew of Tokitsu Kaze as well. And then they just leave that ship to drift off. Mm-hmm. But already they've lost two or three of their destroyers.
Yeah, it's not shaping up to be a good day. And the day isn't over yet. For the remainder of the day, and I do mean all day, in and out of the day, Allied aircraft attacked the convoy. Australian bow fighters hit it again, repeatedly raking the decks of the Japanese transports and destroyers. The B-25s, A-20s, and more B-17s come in and just lay waste to this convoy. Nearly every strike, of which I frankly did not, I neglected
tabulate
to count,
the number, yeah,
but it was a lot. Nearly every strike claims at least one hit. On one ship, and by day's end, seven transports are hit and sinking along with four destroyers.
Yes.
The remaining unhit destroyers rescued as many people as they could and retired back to Rabaul as fast as they could. They were like, we are out of here. The hell with this.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. One of the things they realize is that both the skip bombing and the masthead bombing give much, much better results. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, medium altitude, you were getting, I forget the statistics, it was low single digits, you know, 3 or 4% hit rate. With a skip bombing attack, you know, you're getting almost a third of those bombs were hits, which for, you know, aerial bombing is amazing. Yeah, in World War II. So, yeah, the end result is that this convoy is just absolutely devastated.
Yeah. So it's not over either, because one of the B-17s hits another one of the destroyers. I forget what you say. It is the is it the Horacio or the Asacio? Which
it is. It is. It is Asacio. That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just looking at my notes here. Right. Yeah. One of the few instances where a B-17 actually does get a hit. Obviously, the ship was at pretty low speed because she was trying to pluck survivors out of the water at the time that she gets tagged. And she goes down with all hands. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is where the grisly business, you know, we talked about the Japanese strafing and executing Americans in their parachutes and in the water. Yeah, well, man.
Yeah.
Here it comes.
Yeah. Here it comes.
On the night of March the 3rd, this is the night after or of the event, if you will, United States Navy PT boats get into the fight. There's a bunch of them. I'm not going to list them all. Look it up if you want to know. But it's a fair amount of PT boats. They come in here. And their job is to pick off the remnants of what's left here. And that's to sink the derelicts, whatever you can find, put a torpedo or two or three or four into them and put them out of the way. And that's exactly what they do. However, for the next 2 days and nights, these PT boats roam the water like sharks. And their sole purpose is to kill the Japanese survivors in the water.
Yeah.
Be they in rowboats, hanging on the, you know,
art, yeah,
whatever,
yeah. Piece of wreckage, whatever. Any live Japanese in the water is to be rendered dead.
Yeah,
it's pretty horrific. I gotta say, I have some moral problems with it.
Yeah,
I really do. And you know, the same thing is happening. We're sending aircraft over, and they're doing the same thing. Yep. And you know, some of the aviators are having real issues with this as well. Some of them are throwing up in their cockpits. It's just absolutely grisly work to be, you know, dispatching helpless human beings in the water.
Mm-hmm.
The reasoning being that, you know, well, if these are landed, they're going to be soldiers again. And, you know, they're going to be, you know, potentially killing our guys on the ground. And do we really want to look our guys on the ground and in the eye and say, well, we let these guys get away and now they killed your buddy because of our leniency.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, again, the Pacific really does offer some pretty awful examples of just the depths to which two militaries can descend.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to play the moral equivalency game here. Let's understand that initially, the rules of the game were established by the Japanese, and they were established back at, you know, the battle on Alligator Creek. That really is kind of the bellwether for this whole thing. You know, the Japanese didn't have to fight to the last man, but they chose to do that. And, you know, given that parameter, you know, it's not like we have any ability to alter that. But you get these downstream effects then in battles like Bismarck Sea, where it's just absolutely awful.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's something that, you know, the Navy justified it by saying, as you said, you want to let these guys get to shore, then, you know, they're going to kill, you know, American and Australian soldiers, which, you know, is legitimate.
Arguably true.
But the Navy also said, well, you know, they machine gunned our people, so we're going to do the same thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's tit for tat. And you can't sit here and say that it was a good thing. Either way, the Japanese machine gunning our people or us machine gunning them. But unfortunately, as you said, it is a war, you know, and people sink to levels of depravity that they probably never could have imagined that they would have been able to sink to until situations like this.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure that there were more than one Allied aviator who survived the war and had nightmares from what they had to do.
Yeah. Sailors on PTs are going to do the same thing because they're closer. I mean, at least in an airplane, you're buzzing, you're shooting, and you're gone. In a PT, you're PT, watching them.
Yeah, you're looking this guy in the face as you're killing him. It's just, it's pretty horrible.
That's hardcore. That is hardcore. So the battle ends almost as quickly as it begins, you know, boom. And the end of at the end of the March 3rd, the night, you know, after our PTs and our aircraft are executing people in the water, the battle is essentially over. Of the six. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, the Japanese, too, I mean, on the 4th, Tokitsukaze is still afloat and is attacked by Allied aircraft. She is encountered again by none other than Yukikaze. Who discovers that there are still 20 survivors aboard this derelict destroyer that's floating around here. So Yukikaze pulls off those survivors and then exits the area again. Tokitsukaze is going to be sunk by B-25s later on in the day. But yeah, there's no organized combat, I guess I would say, on the 4th.
Right. Of the 6,900 troops estimated that were in the convoy, roughly 1,200 make it back or make it to Ley. And if you recall, we said between 900 and 1,000 were dropped off by the two DDs on the very first day of the battle. So, I mean, you know, the other people, how do they make it to Ley, or how do they make it to the area? You know, they kind of
here and there, drips and drabs. Yeah, barges, what have you. Yeah, life rafts. A lot of them end up back in Rabaul. Including General Adachi. He will eventually be landed on New Guinea. But, you know, think about what a harrowing introduction to combat for this new army commander, you know, having to witness this convoy just getting shot absolutely to pieces and thousands of his men being killed. You know, the final butcher's bill is close to 3,000, roughly 2,800, 2,900, something like that. Yeah, it's a real walkover. 13 aircrew from the Allies get lost. So in terms of, you know, you're not going to see another encounter as one-sided as this one is until battleship Yamato is sunk on April 7th, 1945. That is even more lopsided in terms of kill ratios, but this is pretty horrific.
It's a beating of biblical proportions. It really is. Yeah. And the loss ratio, the kill to loss ratio is insane.
Yeah.
General MacArthur, true to his everlasting reputation.
As a brilliant PR man, claims 22 ships sunk, not eight, you know, or 12. I mean, yeah.
22 ships sunk, including 12 transports, three cruisers, of which there were zero
to be had.
Seven destroyers, and he also claims that his forces had killed over 12,000 Japanese. They knew damn good and well that there were not 12,000 Japanese in that convoy. They also knew damn good and well that there were not 22 ships, nor were there any cruisers in that convoy, because MacArthur was reading the same Froomail decrypts as was General Kenny. You know, so actually MacArthur got him first before General Kenny. So he was fully aware of this. And, you know, old Dougie Mac, I can never resist taking a poke at him here. This is just, you know,
it's just fiction. It's just typical. Yeah. Typical par for the course for the man.
Yeah. It's it is what it is.
It's what it is.
Yeah. So you said something, the same claim is also, so the New York Times picks this up too,
to
MacArthur's claims, and they, you know, propel it all over the United States, and that becomes gospel truth until after the war. The Aussies kind of do the same thing, right?
Yeah. There's actually you can find it out on YouTube. There is an actual video shot by a cameraman standing in the back of a bow fighter during this operation. And so it's about an 8-minute long video where the Australians are talking about, you know, this Japanese convoy is smashed. It's really interesting footage. Sort of scandalously, though, too, I mean, MacArthur and Kenny honestly try to sort of cut the Australians out of the PR. They're, you know, strictly giving credit to the American forces, which is wrong. just wrong.
Yeah.
So anyway,
again, typical MacArthur. He didn't, and even though he was based in Australia, and a lot of his, as you said earlier in another episode, a lot of his at least initial forces were all Australian,
right?
He typically tries to cut them out because he's a jackass, you know.
Pretty much.
There really no other way to say it. Yeah. So following the fight, the Japanese conceded that resupplying Ley, at least by convoy.
Right. Yeah, think about what this means. I mean, the Japanese at this point in March of 43 throw in the towel and say, we can't use transports to keep this army in supply. From now on, it's going to have to be done by barges and landing craft doing these little, they called it ant transportation, you know, making these little nighttime runs little by little by little down the coastlines and depositing troops and supplies. You know, fast forwarding here, this is one of the reasons why 18th Army is going to suffer some of the highest casualties in the entire Imperial Army. 140,000 Japanese are going to serve on New Guinea, and by the end of the war, only 13,000 of them are going to be left alive. The majority of them are going to die from starvation and disease. General Adachi, for his part, is going to be captured and accused of war crimes. He's going to be imprisoned in Rabaul. He kills himself with a paring knife in 1947 because he is determined that he is not going to go back to Japan, that he wants to be resting where over 100,000 of his soldiers ended up perishing. Imamura, a Theria army commander, likewise, a very interesting guy. He's convicted of war crimes after the war. And once the Allies leave in 1954, he believes that he has not taken sufficient punishment for what ends up happening to his men on New Guinea. He builds a replica of his prison cell in his garden. And as a 68-year-old man, he goes into that prison cell and he lives there until he dies at age 82. So, yeah, there's some real echoes, I guess I would say, ripples from what happens to 18th Army on New Guinea. This really, you can look at this convoy mission as being sort of the beginning of the ordeal of this army, and it's only going to get worse from here.
Mm-hmm. And such was the success of the convoy that the Japanese, you know, what you were saying earlier, you know, they're like, this just ain't going to work.
Right.
And later, I think that I had the numbers here. Post-war, the Japanese admitted to the loss. And this is not just this convoy. This is a bunch of different ways that they're trying to resupply and reman Ley. They admitted to the loss of upwards of 20,000 people.
Yeah.
20,000 people in resupply missions from Rabaul to New Guinea. Yeah. This is just not even, these are the people that don't even get ashore.
Right. Yeah. That shows you in a lot of cases, those losses were happening to A-20 and B-25 strafers. I mean, these pilots would go out on what they call, you know, barge busting missions. You know, you're looking for these barges because they lay up during daylight hours. They try to, you know, put vegetation and stuff over them, or they're going out at twilight and hoping that they'll find these barge convoys when they're out at sea, mm-hmm. and they just shoot the bejesus out of them. That strafer is a perfect weapon for interdicting the sort of transportation methods that the Japanese are going to be forced to resort to.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, these guys make a living off of this for the, really, till the end of the war.
Yeah, this is what they're going to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, there's 25s and A-20s, and the Aussies are flying out of this general area at least until 1945, doing this type of work.
Yeah, barge busting.
Grizzly work. You know, and again, I said it initially, and I mean it. This is one of those events that's not widely known. You know, when you talk about fights in the Pacific War, you know. Even in New Guinea area, you think Empress Augusta Bay, you think, you know, Kula Gulf. But this is a very, very important event, not just Absolutely. Because it eliminates an entire convoy, but it changes their entire, they being the Japanese, changes their entire way of thinking and resupply. And
it has a profound impact on their logistical apparatus in this neck of the woods and how they now have to approach the problem of resupply. Not only in New Guinea, but also in the Solomons, too, because let's not forget that 17th Army is still in the Solomons and it's going to be, you know, in places like, you know, Kula Gulf and, you know, Bougainville and New Georgia. You know, they've got little groups all through the Solomons that have to be supplied. Well, they've got to do the same thing here. They're now going to be running barges down from Rabaul along this island chain, trying to keep those troops in supply. Those same strafers are going to be going after those barges too.
Mm-hmm. And they're good. And as I said, they make a living off of this to the end of the war. They make a living on it. Well, John, I think we ought to wrap this sucker up. Absolutely. Is there anything else you want to throw in there?
I have talked plenty. Sorry for the technical issues. You, Comcast, you know. We'll fix it in edit, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You'll never know.
That's right.
You'll never know. Yep. Well, we want to thank you very much for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast, wherever you receive your podcast. Give us a rating and review. We do appreciate it. Also, if you want to see the video version of this and any of our other episodes, subscribe to our YouTube channel called Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast, and please do subscribe. But we're seeing a lot of views, tens of thousands of views, which is awesome. But subscribe. It helps us out too. If you have a question or a comment, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. So once again, my name is Seth Paradon. I want to thank you very much for listening and or watching. John, thank you for being here. Thanks for being my wingman, my co-host today, and always a pleasure.
My pleasure as well. Thanks so much.
Awesome. We will see you guys next time.